minimal requirements for the Gentiles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's say that's what it's going to go to now.
But this is one of them.
Why isn't this text used?
Yeah.
I mean, that to me, isn't that in, like, I mean, look, it's Acts 15. It's the Jerusalem Council. We're saying, okay, well, what are the Gentiles? You know, what are the, you know, why doesn't, and you know what, I'm guessing it probably was, because we don't get the other side of the argument, you know, so I'm sure this was cited. I'm sure this was cited. But I'm going to tell you, that's exactly what I wanted to bring up. I'm going to tell you why it was disqualified and why it was not used, why we didn't have, why this text isn't used to say, and Gentiles should also be required to keep the Sabbath. Okay. First of all, I just would point out, first of all, this is a contingency text. If you do, it's not like, you know, the children of Israel never got this optional buy-in for the Sabbath. But this language is inviting. And in fact, this is why we, you know, when we originally did at First Fruits of Zion, we used that term divine invitation. Is that what we said? Divine invitation? Yeah. It was, which was a riff off of Ariel Berkowitz's original divine permission. And he used this passage to say, Gentiles have divine permission. And we said, it's a little stronger than permission. You know, so we said, it's more like an invitation to take on the Sabbath, to participate in the Sabbath, that sort of thing. Anyway, don't really. Yeah, there aren't they foreigners? Aren't they? That's what it sounds like here. All right, so I'm going to give you some confusing answers. Maybe answers that will raise more questions. All of Judaism interprets this passage exactly the same way. You will not find a dissenting voice. At least, if you will, it's one that I haven't found yet. I'd be interested. I'd be interested to see it. Really. I mean, I haven't researched it very far, but I looked at the major commentators, right? The foreigners here are converts. They are all converts. They are full legal converts to Judaism. Therefore, these foreigners are Jews. They were foreigners before. Why else are they keeping the Sabbath if they haven't converted? Or, what does it mean, who holds fast to my covenant? I mean, how can you hold fast to the covenant that God made with Israel if you're not part of Israel? You know, it's like, these must be converts. Proselytes. Full proselytes. That's the Jewish answer to this passage. And so I'm certain, if this text was raised at Jerusalem Council, and someone said, hey, what about Isaiah 56? Shouldn't we tell the Gentiles to be keeping the Sabbath too? Paul would have said, who taught you? I sat under Gamaliel, and Gamaliel said, this passage is in regard to converts. You know, that's the majority interpretation. And I'm sure it was the majority interpretation in the first century as well. So in that regard, the apostles did not use this. You'll notice they never quote it. It's never quoted. It never quoted and applied to Gentiles. So the apostles looked at this passage and said, this is converts. And that's the answer. But I think it's wrong. I mean, not that the apostles are wrong. They're right. That's how the passage is interpreted. But it's a really problematic interpretation. This is why it's a problematic interpretation. Because the conclusion then comes to, my house will be called a house of prayer for all. Once again, we come to that position. If all peoples convert and become Jewish, then they're not all peoples anymore. It should say, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all Jews. Right. So, I would contend that there are two meanings to the passage. The passage has to be understood in two different ways. The first way is the apostolic interpretation, which is also the mainstream Jewish interpretation, that this refers to converts. All right? But on another level, I think was Isaiah's original intention, in fact, is that this refers to a universalism. This refers to the same universalism that he was referring to just in the previous chapter when he said that Messiah is going to be looking around saying, who are all these people that came to me, you know, from all the nations? I didn't even know these people. That seems to like flow in the same in the same vein. Otherwise, I see no point in making this statement about house of prayer for all nations, or so what that their burnt offerings and sacrifices are going to be received on your altar. Of course, they're converts. It would make little difference. We have other passages, I think, that we will learn maybe next week that support that interpretation. All right. So the answer to your question, Joel, just to reiterate, is on the one hand, but on the other. Okay? All right. Where are we going to keep reading? Are we supposed to be done? No, we're still good. Okay. Oh, we need to look at how this appears in the New Testament. Remarkably, this amazing passage only appears one time in the New Testament. Isn't that quite the thing? It appears only once, and it's a quotation of the Master when he is complaining about the Sadducees marketing their... Well, they've set up this market. And where have they set this market up? At the temple, yeah. But what part of the temple? Yeah, what part? Well, what? Yes, the only place they could. Yeah, they obviously can't set it up in the actual. They set it up in the court of the Gentiles, which is not technically the temple. The court of the Gentiles is just a big courtyard that Herod had added on in front of the temple. So that's why it's called the court of the Gentiles, because Gentiles were allowed to be in there. And they could go up as far as the Soreg, you know, the dividing wall that said, if you go any further, we'll kill you. What's the problem? This is the court of the Gentiles. We'll set up some stands here. We'll sell some t-shirts, that sort of thing. I'm making a little money on the side. The Master says, wait a second. It's written in the prophecy of Isaiah, my house shall be called a house of prayer. And the rest of that statement? For all peoples. He's talking about the court of the Gentiles, which is the court of all peoples. But you are making it into a tourist trap. Actually, it says robber's den. But same thing going on there. Yeah, right. Well, and the Jews as well. The Jewish people are coming up there buying sacrifices. Everybody has to, the Jewish people have to change money to, it's like, it's a racket going on here. And that second quote, a robber's den, is actually a quotation from Jeremiah 7, which invokes a whole prophecy about the coming destruction of the temple. And he says, when he says those words, robber's den, it comes with the implication of the doom that's hanging over the temple. Okay. No, I don't know. I mean, maybe. Mostly they were just mad at him at that moment. Guys like letting my chickens out or whatever. Yeah, the New Testament is thick like that with these. Every quote, the Tanakh, it comes with more than just the quotation. It comes with the context of the quotation. All right. But yeah, it's astonishing then, isn't it, that this text isn't quoted anywhere else? Mm-hmm. Yes. But I think, even though it's not quoted anywhere else, I think it's in the minds of our apostolic writers when they continually are referring to, especially Paul, once again, continually referring to the assembly of Messiah, to the believers, as a living temple. Because, and Paul even goes into that metaphor in Ephesians. He says, he is our peace. We're going to look at that in a moment. He's removed the dividing wall of hostility that stood between us, you know. And so he's, it's this idea of a house of prayer for all nations. That's the assembly of Messiah. All right, let's go over there, in fact, and visit that. But first, we got to read a little further. Jump to chapter 57, verse 14. Remember when we started the book of Consolations, Isaiah 40, and we were talking about John the Baptist and Elijah coming and the road construction crew getting ready for the entourage of the king and the procession, the coming redemption? We're back to that. And it will be said, build up, prepare the way, remove every obstacle out of the way of my people. Now, previously, it was out of the way of the king who's coming. Now we're saying out of the way of my people. For thus says the high and exalted one who lives forever, whose name is holy. I dwell in a high and holy place and also with the contrite and lowly of spirit in order to revive the spirit of the lowly and to revive the heart of the contrite. It's a famous passage. This, we actually read this on Yom Kippur. So Hashem is saying, you know, we're using all this exalted language about the transcendence of Hashem. He's high, he's exalted, he lives forever, he's far beyond, he dwells in a high and holy place, he's totally beyond humanity, he can't be reached, we can't apprehend him, we can't get to him, yet at the same time, he's close to the lowly, he's close to the brokenhearted, he's close to each person, and he comes to revive the heart of the contrite, of the penitent, the one who repents.